An instrumented watershed is a piece of land that, at Syncrud, is a piece of land that we've reconstructed that's a full watershed, which means it's an integrated landscape of uplands and wetlands and the water bodies that connect, that take the water off of a landform and lead it from the uplands down through the wetlands down to the streams that would feed a river. And an instrumented watershed is, at Syncrud, is one where we're tracking all of the moisture, all of the water that is moving around that watershed, and all of the things that are moving around in the water, and the plants and the various organisms that are living in that landscape.
Why is that a concern for Syncrud?
It's really important for Syncrud because we reconstruct large areas of land. We reconstruct landscapes because our mining takes out landscapes, and we have to put back a landscape that can function in a way that was very similar to what was there before. And so we reconstruct entire landforms, entire landscapes, and the watershed is the functional unit of a landscape.
Now, you're doing this in the boreal forest, or what would have been the boreal forest before it was mined. What are some of the challenges that you face when you're dealing with boreal landscape as opposed to somewhere else in Alberta?
Well, the boreal landscape, of course, is dominantly a treed landscape. We're not putting this land back to an agricultural system, and so you're looking at a very diverse landscape of mixed forest and wetlands, and so we have to put back a diverse landscape. So we can't just focus on uplands or just focus on recreating a wetland. It has to be an integrated, functioning landscape that grows trees for centuries and supports all of the land uses that would be used in a boreal forest, which is very broad land uses. So that's the challenge of recreating a landscape in the boreal forest.
So how do you go about reconstructing it?
It's really a very large team effort that involves research and technology and engineering to implement research, is how it goes, basically. And we have a team of engineers and scientists at Syncrud who take the fundamentals of watershed function and convert it into landform design and soil placement and revegetation.
When you look at the different layers of the soil then, what it was like before you took it off and then you have to put it back, are there any special preparations? Do you save the overburden or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We salvage all of our soil materials from in advance of the mining operations. So we go in and we salvage, and you use the right term, there's overburden, all of the material that sits on the top of the oil sand, which varies depending on which mine you're at. But the very top, the really critical layers are in the top, mostly in the top meter, but up to the top 3 meters, and we selectively salvage that material, the organic soil layers at the top, and then the mineral soil layers below, and we reconstruct them in a way that's similar to what was there before. So we learn from the soil scientists what was there before, and we attempt to put that back by selective salvage and then selective placement back in the landscape.
Now, you put instruments in that reconstructed landscape. What kind of instruments are you using? How do you place them? How does it work?
Well, that's really fun stuff, the instruments part. And we rely a great deal on our research partners to keep us abreast of the state of the art and how to monitor the fluxes in a landscape. And so a lot of our instruments are trying to monitor where is the water going. So we have numerous climate stations monitoring precipitation and wind speed and relative humidity and the temperature fluxes off the surface of the reconstructed landforms and off the surfaces of the plants that are growing, because of course we have a very actively growing young forest, and every year it changes. Every year it gets a meter higher and change in species, and those plants change the amount of carbon they release, the amount of moisture that they release to the atmosphere. So We use extensive groundwater well networks, shallow ones, deep ones. We monitor net radiation in the landscape. We use a very interesting instrument called an eddy covariance system on various watersheds that that monitors the carbon and the water fluxes in those landscapes, because that's ultimately what it's all about. Where is the water going? Where is the carbon going? Those are the functional processes in a landscape. So that type of thing. We also monitor, we use weirs that are automated to measure the water that's flowing into and out of wetlands. And we have various sensors that measure the salt content in the water bodies that we have, and things like neutron access tubes that we insert soil moisture monitoring devices into, and time domain reflectometry, which are more soil moisture monitoring devices. And it all depends on what the focus of the research that we're doing is the type of instrument that we use. But really looking a lot at water and carbon flux in the landscape.
Now, my understanding is you actually have three different instrumented watersheds right now, and they're all looking at different types of soils or soil conditions. What are those?
Are the three current watersheds that we have are built on three of the main types of materials that we will build landscapes out of at the end of the day. You referred to one of the types earlier, which is called overburden. There's the material sitting on top of the oil sand at Syncrude site is a Cretaceous clay shale, and we call it overburden, and we create landforms out of it because we have to remove that overburden to get at the oil sand, and then it doesn't go away. You have to turn it back into a landscape. The other material type that we have a watershed on is on tailing sand. So, of course, after we've extracted the oil out of the oil sand layer, you end up with clean sand, and we create landforms out of tailing sand. And the final watershed that we have constructed is on one of the byproducts of our upgrading process, which is coke. And coke is a carbonaceous sand that is basically left over after we've taken off all of the hydrocarbons that we would use to create Syncrude Sweet Blend.
Tell me a bit about coke. What happens to the coke now?
Well, coke is actually, it's really neat stuff. At Syncrude, it's a carbonaceous sand, so it's essentially pure carbon. And because it's carbon, the Energy and Utilities Board considers it, and anybody who's concerned about energy considers it a potential future resource as an energy resource for the future. And so we need to store it in such a way that it could be, if technology were developed to utilize it efficiently as an energy resource and in a clean manner, that it could be used again in the future. And so we store it in the landscape in such a way that it could be accessed in the future. So right now the plan is to store it in discrete areas, but then we would reclaim it because we don't know when that technology would be developed, and we don't want to leave large open areas into the long term. So we would reclaim it just like we would any other landscape.
Now, I understand that coke has a lot of sulfur in it. So is there a concern about the sulfur leaching out into the water if it's say buried under topsoil or whatever?
Because of the coking process and the structure of coke, and I'm not a chemical engineer, but we have had to evaluate that aspect of the coke. The issues of sulfur leaching are not the primary issues around coke storage, but we certainly have to keep track of, just like with any material that you recreate a landscape with, you need to keep track of what's flowing in and flowing out of, it's a watershed again, and what's flowing in and out. And so the sulfur actually, it turns out, is not one of the big issues with coke storage per se.
What are you finding out with regard to the instrumented watershed on the coke fields? Does it react differently than, say, the overburden watershed or the tailings watershed?
Oh, most certainly, yeah. Each of these watersheds behaves very uniquely because the material, each material is quite different. And so primarily it's about how those materials transmit water. And coke is actually like a sand, but it's quite a bit different than tailing sand. Tailing sand is like a fine sand with lots of silt in it, so it actually holds more water than like a coarser sand. So you could think of coke more as a coarser sand, although it's quite perfectly round little sand particles. So it doesn't hold water as well as tailing sand, and it certainly doesn't hold water as well as overburden, which is clay. And so water moves through it very quickly, and so it's quite a dry material. So we need to put a soil cover on it that can hold enough moisture to keep the forest going. We don't really rely on the coke for moisture and that type of thing. So that's the difference between these types of materials, is lots about how they hold moisture and transmit moisture. Because the boreal forest, again, it's interesting, but it's situated in an area that's in a moisture deficit. And so moisture holding capacity in soils is a really critical concept and really rules our strategy in soil reconstruction. We try to enhance moisture holding capacity so that the trees will have plenty of water to keep them going.
Tell me about the tailings watershed. What's unique about that?
The tailings watershed is on one of our sand storage areas. And the interesting thing about that watershed is it's a large sand storage area that doesn't have artificial drainage inserted in it. When we place tailing sand, we pour it. It's moved in a pipeline, so it's carried in water, and it takes a while for that water to drain out of the tailing sands. And so it's that water seeps out at the low points in the landscape, where the wetlands would be. And what we found from studying that watershed and its groundwater regimes is we've determined that the type of configuration that you need to build tailing sand landforms with to create enough relief in the landscape to allow the reestablishment of groundwater regimes that allow for that water to drain in a quick fashion and to support the wetlands that you are trying to put in those watersheds. So we had built an area that didn't have much topographic relief and another area that did have quite a lot of kind of hills and valleys, and the one that had lots of hills in it had flushed and had the water had drained out of those sands quicker, and so then we got this nice diverse upland wetland sequence of landscape, and a lot of that work came out of a lot of the groundwater research that we did in that area.
Is there a concern over toxicity from the tailings?
The tailings water is salty, and it carries residual naphthenic acids, which are natural in the oil sand formation. And so there is concern in the short term about the naphthenic acids in the water as well as the salinity. And so salinity management and planning, designing the landscapes so that the groundwater flushes and has time to naturally attenuate the naphthenic acids and flush out the salts is a key feature of our landscape design, and our research is to figure out how to optimize that in tailings-based landscapes. Yeah.
Syncrude has been working on these instrumented watersheds for almost a decade now. What are some of the things that you found out?
We've had lots of graduate students come through their research programs in a decade. But some of the things that that stand out are we've definitely learned about I spoke before about the importance of soil moisture holding capacity in reconstructed soils, and the and how we can reconstruct soils using layering. You know, the layers of the soils that we create are really important in enhancing moisture in soil profiles and hence enhancing tree growth. We've also learned a lot about how these landscapes, again, how we design the land form, the topographic relief, enhances salt flushing. So we've got better advice on how to create the landform design based on, because we want to enhance salt flushing. We don't want salt in any of the tree root zones because trees don't enjoy salt very much. We've learned very interesting things about the selective salvage of forest floor materials to enhance native species establishment, selective salvage and placement of the top layers of forest floors in the reclaimed areas, because there isn't a lot of suppliers of all the native plant species that we want to see in the final landscape. So if we can get that seed bank and place it properly, then, and we have shown that it does enhance native species establishment. We've also shown that if you place the right type of material in the bottom of wetlands, you enhance the reestablishment of the benthic community that's in those wetlands that forms the basis of the food web. And we've certainly got one of the best long-term databases on how an evolving forest, the water and carbon fluxes of a growing forest, what those balances are. And so it's very important for developing models to project the long-term, your expected long-term success of these various soil prescriptions and landform design prescriptions. So it's a whole suite of research that has led to changes in how we build landforms and has modified many of the guidelines that the entire industry uses for reclamation planning.
Do you have any indication at this point how long it would take to actually reestablish the forest where mining has taken place now that you're doing this research with using the instrumented watersheds? How long will it take to reestablish the forest and the necessary hydrology, bringing it back to what it might have been like before?
Well, boreal forests, you don't actually have a boreal forest until, you know, for about 25 to 30 years. So to have mature trees in a boreal forest, it's not a instantaneous process. The interesting thing about the watershed studies is that it shows that as the forest develops, the forest influences how the hydrology develops. And so it's very dynamic system. And so it's the good thing about the watersheds is we're tracking that interaction from planting of the trees all the way to a mature forest. So we don't expect to, we don't claim to ever have a complete boreal forest before 15 years even. It might be even 20. And we're going to study how that interaction evolves over time, because the hydrology does evolve as the trees evolve. It's fundamentally linked. The processes in a watershed are all linked. The trees, the soil ecosystem processes, and the hydrology and hydrogeology of those landscapes are intimately linked. So, and they influence each other. So until the boreal forest is actually, until you have mature trees, you can't say the hydrology is finished evolving or the trees are done and that's it. So right now, 15 years is considered kind of the trees have gotten a good toehold and they're on a good trajectory, and that's when we would start to talk about the fact that the forest is on a healthy path to a mature forest, which is anywhere between 30 and 50 years.
Thank you very much, Clara.
You're welcome.